This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, March 27th, 2015. I'm Caleb Brown. Even abhorrent speech deserves protection. I spoke today with Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education about the cases of public Oklahoma University and private Ithaca College and their struggles with student speech.
So at the University of Oklahoma, I think probably everybody's heard about it by now, there was about 10 seconds of video of students in a fraternity, SAE, and engaged in a racist chant, a really offensive racist chant that involved references even to lynching, using the N-word. There's no question that this was offensive. But the reaction to it is very concerning, in that we've watched a lot of supposed experts on constitutional and First Amendment law come out and figure out a way to say that this isn't actually protected speech. Meanwhile, Eugene Volokh and Chemerinsky, Jeffrey Stone, some of the real big names in constitutional law, they've all come out and said, no, this is protected. And to their point, one of the only cases that really is on point is this case called Papish from the 1970s that dealt with a cartoon on campus that depicted cops raping the Statue of Liberty, and the Supreme Court had no trouble figuring out this is protected speech. The fact that it's offensive is actually all the more reason why it's protected speech. So I don't think there can be any question that this is protected. Now, a caveat here. I make no bones about it. Fraternities consistently give us the least sympathetic free speech cases on campus. And what I'm and I talk about this in my book on Learning Liberty is it seems to follow this pattern, like it did in Yale back in 2010, I believe, where students were also engaged in an offensive chant, where fraternity members an offensive chant, and they got in trouble. And then a lot of times when they get in trouble, the chanters end up getting kicked out, and that's perfectly within the rights of the fraternity to do that. A lot of times the national fraternity will decide not to derecognize the entire fraternity, which is a fairly dramatic step. But then there's sometimes additional steps taken. Now, at University of Oklahoma, it absolutely legitimate for the fraternity to kick those members out if they wanted to. It's a voluntary association. And it's completely within the rights of the national fraternity to derecognize that chapter if they wanted to. But the additional steps of immediately expelling the students who were caught on tape, that poses easy and obvious due process issues in addition to First Amendment issues. And derecognizing, getting rid of the entire fraternity does as well.
Words, again. I mean, as heinous and offensive as those words are, it is words.
It is words.
They're not fighting words.
Right. They're not directed at someone. It doesn't fit any exception to the First Amendment. And watching, for example, Jeffrey Toobin on CNN, someone who I think likes to think of himself as trying to be fair about constitutional law issues. But he talks about this as being a tough issue. But what he had to do was transform this into a public, officially sponsored event that these students were participating in, and it wasn't. It was a event they were traveling to, a private event they were traveling to on a bus. And he also, what really worried me about his analysis is he ended up saying, well, these are campuses. Of course there's different rules that apply because of course they have to have less free speech because they try to create welcoming environments. And this to me is the ultimate victory of this mentality that is the complete opposite of what it's supposed to be. The former understanding, the papish understanding of campuses is if anything, free speech should be more protected on campus. Then there's Charles Blow take on this. When he was interviewed on CNN about this, he kept on talking about this 1988 Supreme Court case. I mentioned it over and over again. And the only case he could possibly mean is a case called Hazelwood v. Kuhlmeier, which is a case limiting the rights of a high school journalism class students' free speech rights in the context of a journalism class. It was actually a fairly narrow holding, but also there's decent case law saying this absolutely does not apply to colleges. Some other lower courts sometimes try to sort of invoke it, but it's Fire's position. I think it's absolutely correct. There's no way you can square Hazelwood with existing precedent on colleges. So really part of the argument has been this, just like Eric Posner has been arguing, essentially trying to move what I consider in some cases troubling case law even for high school students into the college sphere.
Now, what makes this case potentially worse, this Oklahoma University, is that, as you point out, the fraternity's not really fighting back. The students themselves are not really fighting back, essentially allowing the social sanction
right.
to allow opponents of free speech to win.
Right. We don't know what the students are going to do, but my guess is they're probably not going to fight back. There's been some indication that the fraternity itself will fight back, and definitely, if they do, FIRE will be lending its support. And I want to be clear here that there's been a lot of discussion about high value and low value speech in this discussion, and it's something that sometimes you get the person who doesn't quite understand some of the deeper principles of free speech say, "How could you possibly say that this is valuable speech?" And here's the point. Knowing that people are racist is an incredibly valuable thing to know. People are forgetting the larger informational idea, and we end up making these sort of normative judgments about horrible things that people say. But then it's like, so really ultimately what you're saying is, I'm better off not knowing what people really think.
This is a example from, I suppose, a different angle, but this is something that campuses are dealing with all the time, which is so-called microaggression. Which is typically a slight of some kind.
Right.
Somebody isn't recognizing your value, uniqueness, importance, background, ethnic origin, et cetera, et cetera. And Ithaca College in New York has done what?
Yeah, Ithaca College. So microaggressions is, in my opinion, in some ways potentially a useful academic theory where that actually started way back in the 1970s, where you had one professor talking about slight racist slights that people do unconsciously. Studying that is interesting. That's fine. But unfortunately, this idea has been embraced recently. And by students, and they've started this sort of language policing of microaggressions, and this has been going on in a number of campuses. Sometimes informally, like at Princeton, they set up websites that report them. But Ithaca College has really outdone itself. It's set up student government has set up an anonymous reporting program for microaggressions that would also creepily track the demographics of the people who report the microaggressions and the people who are accused of engaging in microaggressions. And I want to be really clear. Microaggressions can be practically anything. They can be anything that is perceived as a slight. Examples that I've seen in the past have been, some things that might be like, insensitive, like asking someone who's like third generation American, like, what country are you from? Or but other examples are like, where's your family from? Or is that or one, another example was, ooh, nice boots, or nice, like sarcastically saying someone has a nice car, because that's a class microaggression. And there's an obvious problem here is that we're policing, is that it encourages policing speech and obsessing over these slights that might not even actually have been slights at all. Now, this is problematic on a lot of levels. Ithaca's a private college, so they can have this program. But it's invoked in the name. Oh, but also Ithaca College, if they want to have this program, they sure better get rid of their promises of freedom of speech that they have made to students. And they make strong promises of freedom of speech. But the idea that it's flawed from the get-go. Certainly, this on a public college, this wouldn't survive First Amendment scrutiny for a second. But there's something beyond that. The idea that we're actually going to increase dialogue, increase tolerance, increase the productivity of interaction between people who are generally different by walking on eggshells, by being uptight as possible and scrubbing our speech of anything that could be offensive, while at the same time encouraging people to be as offended as often as possible, it's not going to work. It's not good for pluralism. It's not good for dialogue. I think that ultimately this is going to achieve the exact opposite of every goal it is stated to want to achieve.
In promoting this idea of policing speech in order to avoid slights and perception of slights, what does that say about the attitude of the speech police toward people who might be offended?
Mm-hmm.
It seems that
patronizing. You mean?
It seems incredibly patronizing.
But that's one thing that seems to have fallen out of the discussion and really has to be emphasized. Is that the idea undergirding this is this idea of people being incredibly fragile. that essentially that if you say something wrong, it's a deep, deep wounding harm that essentially students can't cope with. Now, that's the stated reason for it. This kind of a John Heights care ethic taken to the ridiculous extreme, where essentially anything you say that might be insensitive is, of course, absolutely immoral. But I will say that there is also a darker side to it, which is that this language policing sometimes, and I think Jonathan Chait wrote a really interesting article about this in New York Magazine, talking about how it's sort of weaponized, about how sometimes, sure, it might be sincerely used to try to on a quest to make people more sensitive and kinder and more inclusive. But a lot of times it ends up getting used as a weapon to basically say, listen, I'm not listening to anyone who does not say this exactly right. And this is one of the things that I find so amazing, is that they talk about class in this. They talk about wanting to police class microaggressions. Meanwhile, those of us who have worked with inner city high school kids, or worked in factories, or worked in other countries, done manual labor, worked in restaurants, the idea that they don't seem to be understanding is what they're really saying is that unless you talk like, say, a PhD in social science from Smith or a PhD in social science from Harvard, that you should not be allowed into the discussion.
Or at a more basic level, you don't understand enough about the things that I know in order to have a conversation with me.
That's exactly right. And this gets back to the whole idea of epistemic humility, that essentially that we need more of that in the way we talk to each other. The idea of a Buddhist idea of humbly approaching someone and saying, I want to hear how you actually would talk as a genuine person to me. That's great. That could really be productive for getting people to talk across lines of difference. The idea of instead approaching them and saying, you said something slightly wrong according to what I learned in college. How much more elitist and Victorian can you get?
Greg Lukianoff is the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. You can read more on free speech and what it means at our website, cato.org.